Someone has said that it all started in the Garden of Eden. I don't know whether it was an eyewitness account, but this is the account I got. God said to Adam, "Go squeeze Eve's hand." And Adam said, "All right, fine." And he started away, and he turned back, and he came back to God, and he said, "Lord, what's a squeeze?" And God told him. So he went and did it. A little while later, God said to Adam, "Adam, go kiss Eve." And Adam said, "Fine." And he started away, and he came back, and he said, "Lord, what's a kiss?" And the Lord told him. So he went and did it. And then finally, the Lord said to Adam, "Adam, go forth and multiply." Adam said, "Fine." He left. Came back in a little while, and he said, "Lord, what's a headache?" And from then on, it's been one of the most interesting parts of the whole ball game. The subject is sex isn't just for babies anymore, part one. Part two, really, is more the constructive aspect of this reflection. It's entitled, basically, "And Never Was." But part one really deals with a statement of a premise I'd like to share that's a deep, deep conviction of mine, and then the problems behind that premise, and then next week, hopefully, dealing with what do you do about it. It's very definitely, very realistically, a part one and a part two sort of thing. But I really believe, of course, tradition tells us that sex is primarily for procreation. The church, Puritanism, Victorianism, polite society, just about everybody you can name says that sex primarily and fundamentally is for procreation. I believe that's part of it. You know, I'm willing to concede something to tradition. But I think the most single important, helpful, and healthy thing that can be said about sex and for sex is that sex is primarily and fundamentally the most astute, succinct form of communication. And I'd like to lay that down as a premise, then I'd like to talk about what has messed up that premise, and then next week, what can be done about it. But in the few years that I've had in my life at 45, and about 19 of them spent in an awful lot of marriage counseling and an awful lot of my own marriage, I have really come to see that there is nothing in the world that is more communication-oriented than sex. Nothing in the world says how much I love you or how important you are or how much I respect you or how beautiful you are or how equal you are or how warm you are or how attractive you are. Nothing. No, words don't come close. To paraphrase Churchill and his description of democracy in saying that it was the poorest of all forms of government except all others ran second and third, I would say that communication by word has to be one of the poorest forms of communication there is. In fact, the Temple University studies on communication tells us that only 7%, the message we hear from someone else is only 7% verbal anyway. And I know for a fact, and I'm prepared to say this in a very high, to a very high-powered group of auditors or listeners, whatever, that communication, that more marriages are messed up by this form because it is not perceived as communication than any other single way. There is no way I can better tell you in a marriage how important you are to me, how equal you are, how very precious you are, or can I tell you how ugly I think you are, or how utilitarian I feel about our relationship. You're just a tool. You are a utility, like a water faucet. I turn you off and I turn you on and I turn you on and I turn you off, and I need you only when I want you, and I love you because I need you. And that's communicated sexually, and all the words and all the flowers and all the other things do not offset that, because 58% of that which we perceive the other person is sending us message-wise is totally nonverbal. In fact, 93% is nonverbal. It tells you how unequal you are. It tells you so many things. It isn't that sex should be looked upon as communication. It is communication. Now, we tend to get two words thrown together here. We tend to interchange the word information and communication. Information is giving out. Communication is getting through. And an awful lot of couples today trying to work through this thing confuse those two. I'm not talking about information, because you can do that verbally. We give out verbally. But when we get through to one another is primarily in a sexual form. And so I have really come to believe, and I've thought about this now, you're the first bunch I've said it to, but I've thought about it for an awful long time, that sex fundamentally and primarily is the most succinct form of communication that really bears the soul to the other person than any other single source that we have for communicating. Very, very greatly. Remember last week, I said in a very poor way, but the best I had at the time, and it's not any better tonight, that sexual gratification is cerebral anyway. It isn't physiological. It isn't the performance. It isn't the orgasm. It is primarily something that has to do with the brain. You see, I feel sexually gratified in the marriage. We feel sexually gratified in the marriage when that other person looks upon us as a person that they want to be with, and that the partner is so important in their lives, and that they are equal, and that they are loved, and that they are special. And that's why sexual gratification is a matter of the mind and not the behavior. It's not a matter of the marvelous family orgy, though I think all families ought to have a wonderful family orgy from time to time, unless you live by yourself or you're not married. Someone asked me if I was going to deal with sex as pertaining to single people, and possibly next week we'll have some material, but by and large, no. This is primarily geared to why good marriages go bad. And I'm saying in relation to this, in this fourth study, that one of the fundamental reasons they go bad is that good marriages often talk a lot. They talk a good marriage. They say all the right things. But what I really feel about my partner, I communicate sexually. It is the prime form of communication. Now, this is what's behind the statement, that sex is basically a thermostat and a thermometer. I find that by far the vast majority of the marriage counseling I do usually involves sex one way or the other, usually symptomatically, but it is an integral part of the problem. A lot of behavioral people who are behavioral psychologists, people who've done studies in this area, give it a very high figure of involvement in our lives as far as the problems it caused. But I'm saying that the real problem behind it is that we're not really as aware as we ought to be of what we are saying to one another, how very much we are communicating. Sex is a thermometer. It is a thermostat. It tells more about your marriage than any other single thing that's available. It isn't the cause of the problem. Often it isn't even clearly symptomatic of the problem. But it's a thermometer. It tells more about your relationship and more about your marriage than any other single thing. I think doctors who are in any special field look for special symptoms, and those special symptoms tell them something about the malady. In marriage counseling, this is a fundamental and primary symptom. It is also a thermostat. It doesn't just tell you what the temperature is. Sex does an awful lot toward determining the temperature. Now, what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is go from that to talk about what's happened to the thermostat. And then next week to talk about what do you do about it. And I've really struggled with this because it's a very difficult thing to say, and it's a very simplistic thing to say, and yet I feel very confident in what I'm getting ready to say. And I plan to break it down in three basic categories because it begins very early and it continues right on through our lives because our marriage changes, our lives change. We have to keep making adjustments. We have to keep communicating on a new level. And the most successful marriages have always been those that have been geared to what the other person is feeling. The most successful sexual encounters, hands down, in any study, have been always those where one partner is more concerned about where the other partner is sexually satisfied than whether they are. Communication. I'm trying to get through to you and tell you something. But this has really fallen on hard times. The sexual revolution that's happened in my adult life has done more to change this picture in an everyday counseling situation than any other single thing. When I first started in marriage counseling almost two decades ago, this problem would occur. I mean, real difficulty, sexual problems in marriage. This, I haven't thought this through, but I would say probably 25% of the time. Now it's closer to 75 or 80% of the time as I see it. Now, what's causing the problem with the thermostat? Well, number one is childhood orientation. I talked about that. I'll just hit it very briefly. The inner child of the past. Hugh Misseldine, in his book, Your Inner Child of the Past, has a chapter that says, in essence, that when you get in bed with your wife or your husband, there are six people in bed. Now, if you've wondered why it seemed crowded, that's why. There are six people in bed. There's your mother and father and him and your mother and father and her. And they're all there teaching you what they've taught you, reminding you, and that plays a very great part. And so often this is what I've referred to the last two evenings in the philosophical use of the term as the pathological problems of childhood, pathos logos. Pathos, the suffering or the hurt that is within me that's trying to speak. And so that's where it begins. Some of us are taught that sex is good and that sex is bad. Some of us are taught that sex is healthy and that sex is sick. Some of us are taught that sex is something you participate in or it's something that you endure. We're taught that it's a punishment, that it's a leverage. And it is, in fact, used for all those things. It's withheld. It's given out. It is all those things. But it really begins in our childhood orientation, our pathology, our pathological, what we saw in our own homes. And I say again, the older we get, and particularly when we get to middle age, and particularly when we begin to perceive ourselves the way we first were really aware of our parents, we tend to go home. And an awful lot of good marriages go bad because here are intelligent people who've made a good, clear, and sensible choice in their marriage, and they've rocked along for 18 or 20 years, and their sex life has been good, and it's been meaningful and satisfying and gratifying. And then they begin returning back to how mommy and daddy did it because they quit using their brain. Say again, and I'll say it some more. Probably the single biggest problem in marriage today is that when we stand at the altar and say, I do, we leave our brains there. We go to the job, we go to our work, and we take our brains with us, but when we get home, we don't want to have to think, so we begin reproducing the environment that our mind is acclimated to. Number one, early childhood. Secondly, are the adolescent years. Now, I was going to leave this out, but I've decided not to because, number one, I think it's good material for those of you who are being raised by teenagers. It's not really pertinent for all of us who are here. For instance, me. At age 45, I mean, even in Avon Park, we had girls. You know, it wasn't that there were no girls around, and it wasn't that we were interested. Of course, you know, as I was going into the ministry later on, it was never an interest I had, but there were other guys in town. There were other guys in town that were interested in girls, and I heard a lot of stuff. But the problem wasn't as severe as it is now. Today, the sexual revolution, with all of its so-called freedom, and all of its openness, and all of its non-uptightness, and all that kind of stuff, and I want to get more into the handling of that next week, but with all that stuff, has caused more problems sexually in marriage than anybody had when I started counseling, and especially back before that. I'm not saying that atmosphere was healthy. I'm just saying it wasn't causing some of the problems. And in marriage, or in the teenage years, here's basically how it goes. Now, I'm going to give it to you, as I have with most of this stuff, though I have stolen very liberally. I've always given credit. I'm not going to blame this on anybody. I'm going to try to say, in the high school years and in the marriage years, what has been the fundamental disruption of the thermostat before we start talking about how to fix it. And here's the way it begins in the teenage years. Now, let's take a hypothetical couple. Let's take Effie Mae and Ortho. Now, Effie Mae has had the wild woolies for Ortho, this beautiful hunk of man, all of her life, all through grade school and middle school and now in high school. I mean, she is 17. You can't get any older than that. You can't know any more. You can't be any more mature. You can't be any smarter than your parents. She is really ready to go. She lives in a society that is bombarded, I use the word subliminal stimuli, where all this impact on our little blue gourd, you see, it isn't the information we're getting, it's the poor information, it's the misinformation, but more important than that, it's the high pressure cooker, overstimulative information that is being so lethal. Now, finally, Ortho asks her out for a date. She can hardly stand it. This is just marvelous. Now, two rules. Number one, in the average human being, emotional stability does not begin to enter the psyche, the soul, the body, the person, until about age 25. Make a note on that or write it down in your mind. Age 25. I know one guy's 87, doesn't have it yet. I'm just talking about the average person does not begin to acquire emotional stability until age 25. That's very critical. I'm going to tie all this together now. Really, I think it's awfully important. Keep that in mind. Secondly, there is a law used in a lot of things called the law of diminishing returns. It goes like this. In all ego-centered activity, you've got to increase the stimuli to maintain the original response. Let me illustrate it. If you've been sitting in a class all day or in a desk or wherever, totally immobile, you go out at 4:30 and you get in your car and you start down the road. Now, driving a car is ego-centered. I mean, you drive a car in such a way as to make you feel good. You don't drive it to make the car feel good. If you do, you've got a pretty weird car. In all ego-centered activity, and driving a car is ego-centered. Okay, so you're driving along at 10 miles an hour, and that feels pretty good. But in really about 18 seconds, 10 miles an hour doesn't feel all that much. So you up it to 20 miles an hour, and you say, now that's more like it. Clinically, it's the same feeling you had at 10. But because you're involved prior to emotional stability, in a self-centered activity, you've got to increase the stimuli to maintain the original response. You're not feeling any better. You just double the dose. And then you're sailing along at 20 miles an hour, and that feels more like it until the bicycles come whizzing by, and you kind of get the feeling you're not going anywhere. So you step it up to 40. 30 won't do it. You step it up to 40, that feels better. Well, you know the story. You get out on the interstate, even in the good old days when you could drive 70 miles an hour, after 30 minutes of that, you felt like, just like you did at 10, going nowhere fast or slow. This is an ego-centered activity. You've got to increase the stimuli to maintain the original response. All dating is ego-centered. We don't date people because we feel sorry for them. We date people, and Playboy's made $10 billion off this. We date people because of how they make us look. The whole utilitarian concepts begins at the very innocent form of dating. And many of the problems a lot of people are having in their marriage lives are rooted right in here. And some of us aren't all that old to have been exposed to some of this. But it's an ego-centered activity. Okay, let's go back to Ortho and Effie-Mae. He asked her for a date. Now, I was going to bring in an overhead projector and try to put some graphs on this wall behind me, but I'm having enough trouble without somebody else up here with me. So I'm just going to wave in the air, and you just hold on and try to stay with me. But now, let's use mile per hour. Let's say they start out at zero. You know, there's no big deal there. He asked her for a date. They go out on their first date, 10 miles an hour. I mean to tell you, she is just excited. This is the most glamorous night of her life. There's nothing they could do that would bring any more than getting in the car for the first time. They're off and running and ready to go. Second night, second date, step it up to 20 miles an hour. And especially, this happens much quicker. It used to be 15 dates, now it's the second date. Step it up to 20 miles an hour, because in all ego-centered activity, you got to increase the stimuli to maintain the original response. And so they're saying, hey, man, this is really living. You know, she's sitting there with glassy eyes and steam coming out of her ears, and he's just as excited, and this is really great. Then they step it up to 40. Now, at 50 miles an hour, the most common question that kids ask me in retreats is, how far is too far? Now, does that mean you shouldn't go past Hawthorne, or how far is too far? Well, clinically speaking, you see, if 55 miles an hour is the speed limit, then emotionally there is a buffer zone. I've got a straight road here now. Let me just draw a graph. There's a straight line here. It's like pedaling a bicycle down a street. Even without emotional stability, you're pretty much in control, pedaling it down the street. Then at about 45 or 50 miles an hour, it starts down a hill. Then at 55 miles an hour, it goes straight down. Now, this is prior to emotional stability. If you ever pedaled a bicycle along a level road, you know what I'm talking about. Have you ever pedaled one down a hill? Have you ever pedaled a bicycle down a wall? Okay. When you're talking about adolescence prior to emotional stability, it's the distance from the end of that hill to the bottom of that wall that disrupts most marriages initially. And I'm going to tie that in when I get into the third segment on the adult problem. But they turn that corner. The answer to how far is too far is 45 miles an hour. Anybody ask, you tell them. 45, they'll think you're very, they'll be very impressed. 45 miles an hour, because you see, there's got to be a buffer zone. We get into that period where one of the interesting things here is that kids today, all people getting married, can discuss sex better before marriage after 45 miles an hour than they can for the first 7 years of their marriage. Most studies I have read tend to say that it takes the average couple about 7 years to reinstate the candor and deal with the lack of objectivity that's now been dissipated in a close relationship, to be able to communicate as thoroughly as they could before they got married on sex. It's far more intimidating now, much less subjective, and some of the causes of that I'm getting to. So here's Ortho and Effie-Mae. They're sailing along. They hit 40 miles an hour. That seems great. They turn the corner. Now, church kids like to talk about this a lot, and they pray about it together. I'm being very serious, and I'm not being unkind at all. I hear it all over the country. We prayed about it. Listen, sex is not an ugly thing. Sex is a beautiful thing. Sex is the most precious form of saying how important you are to me. And that's why sometimes when it's not done, it's more affirming than when it is done in certain situations, because it really tells how important you are. And it's not just the doing it, but the not doing it. And here we have this couple, Ortho and Ephime, talking about sex, trying to come to grips with it, praying about it. It isn't an evil thing. There is nothing evil in itself, Paul says. Unto the pure, all things are pure. There are some things you don't pray about when you get there. There are some things you pray about before you get there to make decisions about it. Because after you get there, it doesn't seem wrong. Because it is a beautiful thing. It is a proper thing. This is what the word adultery means. The word adultery means literally to take that which is good and make it dirty. Sex is not dirty in itself. But to take that which is good and make it dirty. The word fornication comes from the Greek word porneria. We add another word to that, graphos, which we get our English word pornography. But what it literally means is, the Bible says something about fornication and adultery, and let me tell you something, troops. There is more sex crime within marriage, I don't mean outside of marriage, but within marriage, than probably outside of marriage. And so I raise the question, what's happened to the thermostat? Okay, I'm getting to that. Pornographos literally means to treat you in such a way that I'm gratified no matter what it costs you. Now, pornography means just to put it in writing. But see, I can be a fornicator in my home. If I use you, if I've just gone through this early childhood orientation, this adolescent orientation, and some of us are having what some very kind clinical people call spasms of re-adolescence, is really called middle age. But we go back and try to pick this thing up, and we get into the same syndrome. And here they are, they hit 45 miles an hour, they scoot down to 55 miles an hour. At 55 miles an hour, you're pedaling a bicycle straight down the wall. You can't handle it, and just because you can do it doesn't mean it's right, and doesn't mean you should. And in fact, so much of the clinical, I use that word with a little sense of pretentiousness, but not a whole lot. But when I try to deal with this clinically, I find that so much of the sexual disorientation is because we've listened to a sick society. We have been duplistic or pluralistic. We have done our own thing. We have been pornerios. We have done it at the expense of you, no matter how it affects you. It helps me, and that's all we're interested in. And here's often a very nice high school couple or somebody in their spasm of re-adolescence, and most of the damage is done between 55 and 100. And let me just share something with you folks that you may not know. I think one of the most ludicrous things said to young people today is, you can't be in love. You don't know what love is. I know an awfully lot of teenagers who are a whole lot more in love than a lot of adults I know. Real love. And they're just going to turn you off because they know you're wrong. And if that's so dumb, everything else is going to be equally dumb. Of course they're in love. They are not as careless and as insensitive as a lot of we're led to think as we read the papers. I'm so very impressed with so many of our kids today. But the damage still comes. Now, because they're in love doesn't change that. Inevitably, without emotional stability, it's a matter of simple record that men, whom I have already said are the weaker sex, in my opinion, and you don't have to share that, but emotionally, are much slower toward maturity, especially emotional maturity. Men do not tend to marry women they've had sex with. not just because the mystique is gone, but they just simply don't tend to. The average man in adolescence does not marry people he has sex with. And they go crashing into this thing, and her life is wiped out. And I usually see it in the marriage somewhere where she has had a tremendous disorientation, and I try to say, this is the solution. There are two solutions to this crash at 100 miles an hour in adolescence. Number one is what God can do. I've tried to stay away from church talk because this is a secular thing, and I wanted to make it that, and I think that's very much approved of God. But you see, modern psychology has nothing to say for guilt. Modern psychiatry has never found an answer to guilt. So number one, there is what God can do. But number two is what we can do. I never put kids down. I have them come to me and tell me about their sexual problems and their things they've been through sexually, and I'm neither shocked or impressed any more than I am when some adult tells me about an affair. They're symptoms, they're not causes. And I try to tell them what God can do, but what you can do. Let me give you a typical illustration. I was speaking at Florida Southern College some years ago, and a young man came up to me at the end of the evening, and he said, I've got a real problem in my life. He said, I'm madly in love with, or I have been, with so-and-so for about 4 years, and we're scheduled to get married in about 3 months. And he said, I really love this girl. But he said, a year and a half ago, they've been dating 3 years. Most studies again show that a dating relationship in adolescence is hard to maintain without it being damaging after a year and a half. After a year and a half, it begins to set up roadblocks emotionally in your mind if there is no sex. And if there is, it tends to be destructive. They tend to break off. He said, we've been dating about 3 years, and a year and a half ago, we began to get over the speed limit. Now, that's not the way he put it, but I have a very sharp mind, and I finally worked it out. You know, I kind of thought through it, and I realized what he was saying. He said, we began to get over the speed limit. He said, we went into the bottom of the hill. That was the very word he used. He said, we hit a stone wall. I was pulling the emergency brake out, waving it in the breeze when we hit the wall. You ever pedal a bicycle down a wall? Emergency brakes aren't all that big a help. He said, my quandary's this. He said, I really love this girl, and I'm trying to figure out how to ditch her at the same time. There are things that cannot be done prior to emotional stability without it being damaging, unless those two things, one is what God can do, and secondly, what I can do. So he said to me, what can be done? And I told him about what God can do in forgiveness. And then I said, Let me challenge you to try an interesting experiment. From now on, between now and the rest of the time of your wedding, your emotional mind is just like your physiological self. If you lose any of your senses, all the other senses counterbalance it and tend to heal. It may heal itself, sight, vision, touch, smell, or whatever, or will substitute through acuteness in some other symptom or some other sense. The same thing happens psychologically. I said, you've gotten into something that's over your head. You live in a society that pushes you that way. If you can pull back, you can reinstate. In other words, pull back to 40 miles an hour. Now, that's hard to do. Once the boy's been to Paris, hard to get him back on the farm. And I said, if you can pull back to 40 miles an hour, for the next 3 months, you will find that basically there has been a healing of your need to reject her because it's your own immaturity. And he said, I'll try it. Well, they didn't invite me on all their dates, and I don't know what they did, but I do know they got married, and I know where they're living happily ever after. But that's where it begins. I just want to hit that. Then I want to go quickly to number three. Okay, you get out of adolescence. You go through college or your college age and you get married at the typical age. Now, what is the typical age? Well, the typical age is she's 19 and he's 21. That's the typical age. And don't feel badly if you were 20. I'm just talking about the typical age. Now, I want to give you two or three basic rules, and then I want to say what is basically the real heart of the problem with the thermostat. Two rules. Some of this is very rudimentary. Those of you who had Psychology 201 will remember it, but most of it you haven't heard. Number one, write this rule down. The male of the species, now if you don't know which one that is, I can't help you, but the male of the species enters his period of greatest sexual need between the ages of 15 and 25. Now that doesn't mean after 25 he says, ho-hum, I'm bored to tears and I couldn't care less. We're just talking about the zenith axiomatic period where sexual contact, affirmation, communication, all this sort of thing is so, it's at its zenith period. The female of the species enters this same zenith period between the ages of 25 and 35. Again, that's not to say before 25 she's bored to tears and couldn't care less, especially in this society where there's such constant bombardment, such interaction with the subliminal stimuli of our environment. That's rule number one. Rule number two. Emotions are completely different before marriage and after. Emotions are like a balloon. A balloon's not normal if it's flat, and it's not normal if it's so thin the air's showing. This is normal for a balloon. And so we began today in very early years with 15 pumps pumping that balloon up. This is what I keep calling subliminal stimuli. By the time we get married, there is no way to be hornier, to put it theologically. That balloon has expanded as much as it can hold. And one of the most glaring facts that come out of very extensive involvement in this field is that in marriage, the balloon, the emotions tend to return to normal for that age. Now, within this is the crux of 80% of the marriage counseling I have to do concerning sex, and I really ask you to listen and pray for me as I try to say it. Rule number one, 15 to 25, 25 to 35, and then there's the expansion. You see, dating somebody has no security. There is no psychological security in dating. Dating is like going down the sidewalk with somebody on a skateboard. You may be good at it, but it takes a heck of a lot more grabbing. You know, there's just not that much security, especially prior to emotional stability. That's terribly critical. And most people get married prior to emotional stability. And it's often retarded depending on the pathological problems that we began expressing early. But at any rate, dating is like going down the street on a skateboard. Getting married is like getting on the back of a flatbed truck. You still have to watch the curves, and you can still get thrown off, but it doesn't take as much grabbing. And in fact, one of the single biggest problems in married people is that the more in love you are, the more secure you feel. Now, we're talking about why good marriages go bad. The more in love you are and the more secure you feel, the less sensitive we are to thinking, and the more we tend to just react, leaving our brains at the altar. I can't, you know, the average couple today, why, if they are having sex prior to marriage, they'll spend 2 weeks in foreplay. But they get married, foreplay, gone, just like that. They open the door, then they close it on you. Later, they pull the chair out, and when you get married, they don't. So much physical is left out. Way too much physical is left out. Because after we get married, especially when we feel loved, especially when we feel secure, we stop thinking and start imitating mom and dad. fulfilling the role models and passing them on to the next generation, and the sin of the father is visited unto the next generation and the next generation and so forth in that very real way. And too much physical is left out. That's the main thing I want to talk about next week. But this couple, let me give you now, let me try to weave these two rules together, these two laws. It was nowhere near, from all the study I have done, and that's not just a nice statement, I've really spent some time on this, many, many years. Couples who got married 50 years ago, 100 years ago, in a very uptight Victorian age, had problems, but not as much sexual problems as is being had today. And let me give you the typical graph. Let's say he's 21 and she's 19. Let's stay with Ortho and Effie Mae. Let's just bring them on up and raise them a little bit. Ortho's 21, Effie Mae is 19. Okay, he's in his zenith period. She's coming close to hers. They've been dating. The balloon's expanding. But you see, 50 years ago, there was not all the subliminal stimuli. The TV alone, the misinformation, the constant pumping up of the balloon, the constancy of this pumping. Figured out how she got pregnant. But they had come out of here, all three of them. Don't minimize that at all. All three of them. Down to 14. 11 years prior to this period where she, I mean, you see, the average couple at 21 and 19, the average couple in America today has intercourse 2.5 times. I never understood that half. It always sounded like kind of a drag to me. But so let's just say twice a week, okay? Here's 21 and 19. The average couple has sex twice a week. At 14, once a month, been fine for her. Right. So she drops way out of the sky where they were having sex. I mean, the average couple out here can have sex every night, and often do. That's due to the frayed and highly intensified stimuli and the expansion of the emotions. That's why it's so much easier to get aroused. That's why you don't have to work at it. That's why you don't have to think about anybody else. It takes care of itself. You don't have to grow up. It's all built into the fabric. And now she's dropped to 14. And then they've had five children later, but the marriage is separated drastically. I had a couple come out of church some Sundays ago. As I said this to every couple for years and years now. And you know how people say funny things to the minister when they come out of church, and I never know what to expect. And she came along, she shook my bony little hand, and she said, we have a new joke around our house now. That's nice. What's your new joke? Well, I'd married him about 4 months before. I wasn't thinking about that. She said, we're now saying to each other, did you notice the graph drop? And I still see him walking up the sidewalk, holding hands, laughing. How much better than to say, what's happened to our marriage? Nothing's happened to your marriage. You've got to get that balloon down to normal foundations. The back of flatbed trucks is where you build homes, not on skateboards. Skateboards are for fun, not for building homes. And it's got to happen. It does, in fact, happen. And most couples, I don't care how educated they are, don't know it's going to happen. But it does happen. And all in the world it means is that you feel loved and secure. In fact, paradoxically again, the irony is if you marry somebody, and this happens often, you're not sure they love you, and you don't feel secure in the relationship, it doesn't drop as fast because you use your mind more. There's tremendous paradox in all these problems. So that's the problem with the thermostat. Oh, there's one more, incidentally. Some of the latest research, and I mean in the last very few years, have lifted out another cause to this graph, dropping down and then going into this deep separation at the end, and that's on the problem of climax. Again, here's a rule. Every man is born in the world with the idea that for sexual intercourse to be acceptable and complete, there must be orgasm. Now, that's no big deal because it is for him. It has to be. Physiologically, there's got to be a release. But not for the woman. So many women, you know, just want to be held and loved and could care less about a climax. But he's been told that if your wife doesn't scratch your back bloody, and if she if she doesn't go bananas every time, there's something wrong with you, buddy. And so he begins to create the problem right there. And not only that, do you know that some of the most recent research shows that 25% of all women, now that's 100 out of every 400 for those of you who don't have PhDs, 25% of all women, physiologically, the clitoris, that little nubby nerve ending area at the head of the vagina, is a zillionth of an inch out of position. So there's no friction. No friction. And never have a climax without the finger being used simultaneously. It's no big deal. A lot of couples have had fun learning how. But they don't know about it. And I talk to people who've been married 30 years. 25% is a lot of people. And the brainwashing and what it tells us about being macho and feminine and all that is just so detrimental. 25% of all women can't have climax without the finger being used simultaneously because the clitoris is a zillionth of an inch. But here's another problem. Before marriage, they often can because sensitivity and the emotions are wider, bigger. And an awful lot of couples who live together have climax and don't after marriage because 25% don't. And they think their marriage has gone down the drain and they knew they shouldn't have gotten married anyway. And that's not the problem. The problem is just being sensitive to one another. Here's an awfully good statement from Joseph Epstein of Northwestern University Counseling Program. Once people suffered sexual shortcomings in their partners, and while these shortcomings might be difficult to live with, they were nevertheless generally deemed endurable. They didn't know any different. If love was there to begin with, making love posed no great problem. Those were the good old days. Sex itself had not yet become a highly compartmentalized activity like high jumping. Medals were not yet handed out for performance. People did not yet feel so clearly deprived as they would later if on the sexual side their lives fell far somewhat short of the Arabian Nights on occasion. We're just living in a different time. Oh, it's always been a problem. Aldous Huxley, that brilliant idiot. I love Aldous Huxley. Huxley once described sexual intercourse as a maniac struggling in the musky darkness with another maniac. I think that's great. You know, I'm just enough a dirty old man that I can just see that. A maniac struggling in the musky darkness with another maniac. He must have had one great sex life. Well, look at your sheet in closing. I put in the quote by Epstein, the other one. Perhaps nowhere is more asked of sex than in marriage, which is where it ought to be asked, by the way. Perhaps no other institution is less set up to deal with the modern sexual imagination. See, that's what I've been talking about. The modern sexual imagination is the problem, not your manhood. Not your womanhood. Why, most people are satisfied if they just have somebody that loves them. And everybody has great nights, and then others have disasters. And some of them can laugh about it, and some of them just cry and try again. The ideal of the modern sexual imagination is variety and multiplicity. But in marriage, theoretically at least, one person must serve where multitudes are forbidden. One's wife must not only be a good mother, cook, and housekeeper, but a terrific sex partner. One's husband must not only be a good father, provider, and companion, but give full satisfaction at night. Old dogs are under the constant obligation to learn new tricks. Sexual satisfaction is looked upon as a right, one which is demanded by those not receiving it, and which is shattering to those who are unable to give it. Summationally, sex fundamentally is not orgasm. It is not pleasure. It is not having babies. Sex is communication. Sex is showing how I really feel in the deepest possible way. And for you to know that I am affirming you means more to me than how I feel when it's all over. That pretty well obliterates all the damage in a fell swoop in our society. Sex for what it can be best, and that is a means of potential deepening and enriching one's relationship through learning how to communicate, how to use this beautiful avenue of communication and affirmation. Part one, sex isn't just for babies anymore. Part two, and never was, how do you fix the thermostat? Good evening.